Sharif. Welcome to another segment of Muslim Perspectives. February 2009 marks the 30th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. There have been different opinions about the Islamic Revolution. 30 years ago when it occurred, it was considered by its detractors as a passing cloud. Its supporters in the Muslim world were elated that at long last Muslims had brought about a change that was meaningful and that was going to change the destiny of the Muslim world at least. How different is an Islamic revolution from other revolutions or other changes? For instance, we have had the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and then we have had in recent contemporary history the free officers push that was referred to as a revolution in Egypt, or even Colonel Gaddafi's coup against the monarchy in Libya. Let us consider this aspect and discuss it with two experts that are with me today. On my left is Brother Afif Khan, who is the editor of the Tafsir, the Ascendant Quran. And to his left is Imam Muhammad Al-Asi, who is the Mufassir of the Ascendant Quran, and also a fellow at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Welcome to the program. Let me start off with you, Brother Muhammad. How is an Islamic revolution different from any other revolution?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. The Islamic revolution that we are right now at this time of year remembering its success 30 years ago is a revolution that is principled by Islam. This is not a revolution that reacted to a certain set of circumstances. It's not a revolution that is defined by man-made ideology. It is not a revolution that was, in a sense, limited to a geography or a nationalist group of people.
But wasn't it confined to Iran? Wouldn't that be a sort of geographical limitation?
Well, it begins, of course. Every revolution has to begin in a geographical area, and it just happens that this revolution began in a country that is called Iran. And so in that sense, obviously, it has its geography and it has its borders or frontiers, but it is not limited to that. An Islamic revolution is a revolution that, in one dimension, is located among the Muslim peoples of the world. And here we're talking about a mass area that it extends from the Philippines to the western coasts of Africa. And in another sphere, this Islamic revolution is located among the oppressed peoples of the world, which means that virtually all of the southern hemisphere of the world is a part of this Islamic revolution. So the Islamic revolution in the Islamic revolution that we are speaking about in this particular instance, even though it's called the Islamic Revolution of Iran, in an ideological sense, it belongs to the Muslims and the oppressed peoples of the world. In the political sense, it belongs to the population base in which it is located nowadays, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Now, there is also a very important concept in every movement, and that's the concept of leadership. How does Islamic leadership differ from any other leadership in the world based on any man?
Before we begin to talk about Islamic leadership or other kinds of leadership, let's qualify the meaning of leadership and then talk about what it means to be Islamic or un-Islamic. Leadership generally helps society to manage change. And typically, a society has to decide what has to be done, who's going to do it, and how to hold them accountable. And great leadership accomplishes these things by setting direction and by aligning people to that directional course. And what distinguishes Islamic leadership from other types of leadership is that Islamic leadership acquires legitimacy by defining a directional course that leads to Allah and by setting a target of social justice such that an approach to social justice, its adjudication, its maintenance, and its establishment in society is a target. And that this target is approached by a system of integrated behaviors that are defined by Allah and His Messenger. It's not the type of leadership which expects to change one aristocracy for another or to replace one nationalism with another kind of nationalism.
So it's not a palace coup or a palace reshuffle?
No, it's actually substantive change. What's happening when you have an Islamic leadership leading a movement, delivering a set of rights to people who were historically deprived of those rights. Rights to economic freedom, rights to social freedom, rights to political freedom, rights to political representation. And typically, people in what's considered to be lower classes in Western societies have been historically deprived of these freedoms. And it's the task of an Islamic leadership to establish a directional course which allows people to get the understanding on the inside that they, the nature and the level of their humanity can contribute to this directional course.
Now, obviously when a change comes about in society, naturally the new system instituted various institutions, various activities and so on. There are, it is believed that there are various centers of power in Iran. For instance, we have the leadership, then we have the Majlis, then we have the president, then we have the Shura-e-Nigehban, Shura-e-Maslihat. There are a whole series of these institutions. Brother Muhammad, would you like to shed some light on these very, very briefly?
Well, yes, the Islamic revolution that we briefly tried to outline in the past few minutes, this Islamic revolution has been, very innovative in a sense and very flexible in another sense in its response to the challenges that came its way. We know that this Islamic revolution and its leadership and its foot soldiers, since the very beginning, was not left in a vacuum. There was a war that was launched against it, and there were war circumstances that were imposed on it.
The war that was imposed from Iraq in September of 1980.
That's correct, with the connivance of the imperialist policies of the United States and the Zionist interests in the area, along with the collusion of the official Arabian political system in that general area. They imposed these types of interfering circumstances on basically a population and a leadership with an Islamic orientation and Islamic objectives. And in response to this, this leadership and revolution and its population and its base showed enough receptivity to the nature of the circumstances that they found themselves in. Like in the first 8 years, when this 8 or 9 years when this war was imposed, you had institutions that had a nature of responding to these war circumstances. You had a presidency, and you had a prime minister position that don't exist today. So Iran, in times of war, had institution, and you had Jihadi Sazandegi. That was a popular effort of people who were responding to circumstances of war that were imposed upon them.
But I would like to even sort of step back a little further. Before this war was imposed on the Islamic Republic, there was a campaign of internal sabotage and assassinations of leading figures of the revolution. So there was first an attempt to internally subvert this revolution before the war was imposed, because this internal subversion failed to disrupt the revolution. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes, that's right. There was an attempt to bleed, to internally bleed this Islamic revolution and its wise leadership in the form of the continuous and almost weekly and monthly assassination attempts that were taking place in the first year of this revolution. The frontline cadre of the Islamic Revolution was assassinated one way or the other on different occasions. We have details of history that go back to this particular chapter, but not to lose sight with the point and the question that you posed, and that is the vitality of this revolution in bringing forth the institutions that responded to the circumstances at the time. And we've had a series of these responses that took place in the first 8 years, and then from later on, after the war had ended, we had the coming of age, so to speak, of this revolution to continue its course now in circumstances that were no longer a direct military threat, but now the variation of the war went to a type of economic warfare against this revolution, and the political type of warfare against this revolution and its government, and the challenges and the responses to this that we have noticed in the interim years from when the war came to an end in 1988 until this present day. The Islamic leadership, the Islamic government, and the Islamic authority in Iran has been, in a way, responding to these challenges right now that are no longer a hot war against the Islamic breakthrough that happened in Iran. Now it's become a war in an economic sense, a war in a technological sense. We've seen in the past several years how there's been a sustained campaign to deal a blow to the Islamic presence in Iran and the Islamic pioneering in Iran, effort in Iran, by trying to place it in an accusation or an accusatory position, saying that you're guilty of developing nuclear technology. And that's been right now the pivot in trying to harness different policies in the world in a confrontational position against the Islamic revolution and the Islamic Republic in Iran. And we've seen how capable the leadership has been in responding to all of this. Unfortunately, in doing so, there have been some naive public opinion that thinks that the Islamic Revolution has parted from its principles and parted from its objectives. It has not. It has maintained those principles and objectives while at the same time responding to the political challenges and to the technological news that is beginning to become tightened around this Islamic revolution.
Now, Brother Rafi, one would have thought that, you know, this change was brought about by the people of Iran and their society. Why has there been so much hostility in the West towards the Islamic Revolution? I mean, after all, the Islamic Revolution has not brought about a change in America and the American political system or in the British political system. So what's bothering them? Or what is bothering the Arabian regimes?
Well, one unique aspect of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and its guiding leadership is that they have institutionalized a sense of urgency in their people. And by that, I mean that the people have gotten a sense that they're able to do things on their own and they don't need to rely on protection from the outside in order to achieve the kind of goals that they're after. And so, for instance, when they developed this satellite technology and they joined only 9 other nations on Earth to be able to launch a domestically produced satellite, the reason that the Western world perceives it as a threat is because they have an imperial character, and they only look at the military possibilities of a particular technology. That's all they consider. In fact, many of the social gains in the Western world are only ancillary benefits of a technology that they develop for military purposes. As you know, that they develop nuclear weapons to go out and kill millions of people before they brought power to the desert. But the Islamic Republic is looking at doing things a different way. They've always said from the very beginning that we're going to use these technologies for peaceful purposes, for the advancement of humanity, and for all of those kinds of activities. And the reason that it's perceived as a threat by the Western world, or even by the proxy regimes which are influenced by Western thinking is that they think that the Islamic Republic is going to use these technologies to take them over.
And I mean, obviously, the Islamic Revolution in Iran was not only to bring about technological change or to achieve technological self-sufficiency, but I believe the more important reason was that they broke out of the political stranglehold that the West had imposed on the world. That, you know, it was the first revolution that basically opted out of the international political system that was created by the victors of the Second World War. So, in fact, this was a challenge to their political system that they didn't want to see succeed.
Yeah, because the Western world wants to establish a cycle of dependency in the Third World. They want, in fact, the way that they would like to operate, and what really sort of incenses them, is that there are people out there that don't need Western dependency, and thereby they don't need to employ Western systems to guide their progress. And as far as the Western world is concerned, anybody who gets out of that mold is a threat to the way that they perceive, a threat to their dominance in the world that they live in. And they don't want somebody to compete with them in the area of progress or bringing progress to other third world countries, because the Western world desires to keep those countries in a state of dependence so that their resources can be ascertained to maintain a certain different level of lifestyle in the Western part of the world, continuing to deprive these people from where the resources come from of a certain standard of living which they can only look at on television.
What do you say, Brother Muhammad, if we look at the example of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, I mean, there have been other movements that have been inspired by its example, for instance, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine. And we also now see similar sort of movements even in the non-Muslim world, for instance, in Venezuela. For the first time, somebody in Central America has been able to challenge America, or in Bolivia. Would you say that that's an accurate assessment?
Yes, I think the reverberations of the Islamic Revolution in Iran keep on working their way through the world and through a different cast of leaders and political systems that sought from the beginning to arrest this Islamic revolution inside of Iran and then to have it collapse inside its own boundaries. What has happened throughout all of these 30 years that have been that have passed is that the resonance of this Islamic revolution have gone way beyond the geography and the culture in which it is located, and therefore we have the Hezbollah and Hamas as two examples in the immediate region that are in a certain sense inspired and supported by the individuality, the uniqueness, and the independence of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And as I said earlier, this Islamic Revolution not only belongs in an Islamic context, but it also belongs in the context of the Southern Hemisphere and the oppressed peoples, and that's why it has its echoes in Latin America right now. There's common purpose and there's common grounds between this Islamic revolution that wants independence from imperial powers and the peoples in Latin America and some governments in Latin America that have broken loose or are in the process of breaking loose from imperialist and to be more blunt about it, American foreign policy monopoly that has been the case in the history in the recent past throughout Latin America, both Central America and South America. Therefore, we see that in Bolivia, in Venezuela, as the first two obvious examples of an alignment of policies between the Islamic Revolution and the Republic in Iran and these areas in South America. There are other areas that are moving generally in this direction in Latin America. We see that Nicaragua has had a reconsideration of its policies, and there's been a closeness in relationships between Iran and Nicaragua. We also see that, to a certain extent, Ecuador in Latin America is beginning to fall in this line, and imperialism stranglehold or a chokehold on Latin America is beginning to show a cleavage and a gap because of this breakthrough and this independence and this sovereignty that is beginning to develop in Latin America.
Now, a question emerges out of this that the Islamic Revolution has had its influence so far away from its shores in South and Central America among non-Muslims, and yet apart from Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad forces in Palestine, the Islamic movements within the Muslim world, particularly in the Middle East, have not really shown much sort of, movement or understanding to be able to link up with the Islamic Revolution, to cooperate with it, and to be inspired by its example. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think that's attributable basically to the fact that the two segments of the larger Islamic movements outside of Iran that have been influenced or have had positive feedback from the Islamic Revolution and Republican Iran, Hezbollah and Hamas, these two. The fact of this matter is that these two segments of the larger Islamic movement happen to be at the cutting edge of reality. They are living inside or on the boundaries of the Zionist occupation of Palestine. So they don't have room for the what some people would describe as the comfort or the aloofness that characterizes other segments of the Islamic movement. And therefore, they were very receptive to the ideas and to the principles and the ambitions of the Islamic Revolution, and so they find common cause and common purpose. The other segments of the Islamic movement in other areas, such as in Egypt or in Algeria or in the Arabian Peninsula, just to speak about a limited area, you can throw in there Pakistan and India for that purpose. These areas, or this segment of the Islamic movement, has been suffering from the, what I would call bluntly here, from the Saudi influence. They've been living, some of them have been living in ivory towers. They have problems, all the Islamic movements around the world. They have their own problems. In the Indian subcontinent, the major problem is Kashmir. In the Middle East, the major problem has been Israel. And because these types of Islamic movements or Islamic programs, they've had this cozy relationship with the Saudi government, that caused them to be tardy, to be late in understanding what the Islamic Revolution in the Muslim world means. But as of late, especially concerning the developments inside of occupied Palestine, some of these command positions in the Islamic movement have begun to wake up. And they've realized that the Saudi policies and the Saudi government has anesthetized them for some years now. That anesthesia now is beginning to wear out, and they're beginning to wake up to their own reality. And as they wake up to this reality that they find themselves in, they begin to appreciate what the Islamic leadership and the Islamic authority and the Islamic government in Iran is all about. Therefore now, even as we speak, there are bridges that are being built between the Islamic movement that has been in recess because of Saudi Arabia, between them and the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So the relationships now are beginning to warm up. And of course, this scares the Saudi Arabian government because it has been hiding behind this grand Islamic movement in the world that used to pay homage to the Saudis and used to, in a sense, show no opposition to the Saudi position. The events in Gaza in the past month have shown that, wait a minute, the Saudi government is not what it has been saying it is in all of these years. If it is true to its Islamic character, which it presents to the public, if they are truly the defenders and the promoters of the two harams in Mecca and in Medina, if they believe in the universality of Islamic brotherhood and Islamic solidarity. You know, the word Islamic solidarity was coined by the late King Faisal when Masjid al-Aqsa was burned, or there was an attempt at burning Masjid al-Aqsa the first time around back in the 1960s.
1969, right? August 1969.
Exactly, August 1969. It was King Faisal who convened the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Conference, to bring together the Muslims under the emblem of Islamic solidarity, a tadamun al-Islami. So it was convened because of the issue of the Quds, because of the Palestinian issue. Okay, if you're living up to those principles, there has been a backslide by the Saudi rulers since King Faisal, and right now with the issue of Gaza, when Muslim blood is flowing, okay, where are you here to support the Palestinians?
Now that's the external dimension of the Islamic revolution. I think we probably also very quickly, very briefly, look at some of its internal achievements as well. Earlier on, you talked about the scientific progress. What about on the educational front, the economic front, the political front? Would you like to shed some light on that?
Yeah, let me just add something quickly to what Bill Muhammad said, and I think it's a really important point. The Islamic government in Iran has been consistent for 30 years about who the enemy is. It's been pointing to Zionism and imperialism, and if you repeat that message enough, and you continue to repeat it, one of the impacts of that approach, of continuing to repeat this message, is how Turkey acquitted itself in the crisis, in the war that took place with Gaza. Yeah. And Turkey is a secular state. Even its Islamic party, or so-called Islamic party, still has a secular character. And it's been like that for the entire 30 years that the Islamic revolution has taken place in Iran. But the Islamic government has been continuing to hammer down this point that, you know, we have a set of enemies out there, and they focus on who those enemies are. It's Zionism and imperialism. And that has inspired other governments, even though they're secular governments, to come out and take an Islamic stand in what happened in Gaza. And you would not, you might have expected it more from governments which claim to be Islamic, and you may not have expected that stand from a secular government, and which has a secular history. And so here comes Turkey, coming down on the side of the Palestinians, taking a stand much like perhaps Hezbollah would have taken. And, you know, and this is, these are Sunnis. You know, they're not Shiites, and you wouldn't expect them to have taken, you know, an anti-sectarian response to this crisis. And you can trace the inspiration for Turkey's response back to the Islamic Republic.
But it's a fascinating subject. I'm afraid we can go on, but we are out of time, and I hope that we can discuss it at another time. That's all for today. We were discussing the Islamic revolution in Iran in February of 2009. It is the 30th anniversary of the Islamic revolution. As I said in my introductory remarks, that its detractors were saying when the Islamic revolution occurred that it was a passing cloud, that it would disappear. Yet 30 years later, it's still there, going strong. Iran is one of the most important regional powers in that area. And in fact, it's the U.S. that is on its on the ropes economically, politically, and militarily. So I think people who have been paying attention to what is happening, I think they would know the strength and the power of the Islamic revolution. Thank you very much for watching. You've actually been watching Muslim Perspectives. I'm Zafar Bangash. We look forward to seeing you on another segment next week. Thank you. Salaam alaikum.